Thank you all so much for coming back for round two. It's very kind of you. I hope that we are doing what our intention is, to give you some nice tools to work with in everyday life. It's only 7:05, you know, it's not time to get started yet. But I always kind of like to give a little bonus material to the people who come early. So I think tonight the bonus material I would like to talk about is the prayer wheel. The prayer wheel is a symbol that you'll see everywhere, and some of you may know about it, but here, of course, is one example. Here's another example, a little itty-bitty one. There's some, as you could see, just outside the door. There's some outdoors. I'm sure you've seen pictures in Kathmandu in India. There's some that are gigantic, okay? Some of them are made of metal, some of wood, some are painted, some are not. Some have just a few symbols on them. Some have many, many, many symbols, like on the ones outside. So what are they, and what do they have in common? All prayer wheels, regardless of their size, of the material they're made of, have in common the fact that they have a mantra, a prayer, written on the outside of them, and it is usually the mantra of compassion. Om Mani Padme Hum. We'll talk about what that means. So it's always written on the outside. They're also filled with that written prayer, usually in a little tiny scroll. And what's important about the prayer wheel is to know that when that prayer was inscribed outside and it was filled inside with that prayer, that the prayer was placed there with a lot of intention, with that prayer of compassion. It was put there with a lot of intention of love and compassion for all sentient beings. And the other thing that all the prayer wheels have in common, which is common to any wheel, hopefully, is that they all turn. And just like anything else around, there's nothing magic about it. It's only a tool to help your mind. And the tool of the prayer wheel is for you to turn it. And as you are turning it, you are imagining all the intention of love and compassion for all the sentient beings is spinning out from that wheel to all the universe, to all worlds, all sentient beings everywhere. And you, as you are spinning it, you are then also adding your own intentions of love and compassion and peace for all sentient beings. So that's what a prayer wheel is. And the mantra of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum. It's a six-syllable mantra, okay? And just like with any efforts to translate anything, especially something that's loaded like an ancient prayer, and it's usually, I think that this is Sanskrit. Again, all the prayers are written either Sanskrit or Tibetan, and I'm too ignorant to know the difference, to tell you the truth. But I'm quite sure that this is Sanskrit, though. And Om, the first syllable, is actually when it's pronounced correctly, which I never do. I pronounce it Om, which is kind of like two sounds. But when pronounced correctly, it's three sounds. Om, okay? And that first symbol, the Om, represents body, pure body, speech, and mind. And Geshe-la, our teacher, will even point out that there's three sections to it, you know, body, speech, and mind. And I'm too ignorant to remember which one is which, but it's body, speech, and mind. And Mani is like ultimate compassion, perfect compassion. Padme, P-A-D-M-A, the next syllables, represent the lotus. The lotus is a very important symbol in Buddhism. You'll see it everywhere. In fact, all of our Buddhas and holy people and everywhere you'll see lotuses, are sitting on thrones that represent lotus. And the lotus is very important because it represents the wisdom arising out of the mud of ignorance. A lotus is the same thing as a pond lily, and we all know that its roots are in the mud. And as it grows up through muddy water, and it's clearer and clearer and clearer till it comes up and it opens up into perfect wisdom. So that's the other symbol that's important in Buddhism. And hum can be loosely translated to like, so be it. So one simple translation of the Om Mani Padme Hum is an intention of your body, speech, and mind being transformed from the ordinary to that of perfect compassion and wisdom. And so be it that way. There are many, many other kinds of translations, but that's one that I kind of hold on to. Okay, now it's 7 o'clock, so I guess we will officially start. Thank you all so much for being here. And we start with setting our intention of we could be anywhere doing anything else tonight, but our intention is to do something to improve our minds, to make ourselves more peaceful, so that in turn we can pass on this peaceful mind to those around us that will ripple out to eventually a peaceful world. So thank you all for being here tonight. Again, my name is Elise Strebel. How many people were not here the first time? Oh, there's a few people. Okay. So we're going to be doing a quick review of the first class. Okay. Okay. So our plan for tonight, we're going to start with a meditation and learn a little bit about another meditation called Counting the Breaths. We're going to do a brief review of last week, a brief history of Buddhism, what it means to be a Buddhist, Buddhist view of mind, and more about the Four Noble Truths. Okay. The little asterisk means that if you go to our website and go to spiritual programs to find Buddhism in a nutshell, there are some information sheets you can download, and this is one of them. So when you see a little red star, it means that you have access to information about this on our web. Okay, so the 7-point meditation posture. We talked about how really you don't have to sit like this to meditate. You can be standing, sitting, walking, doing anything. So why has this particular technique been passed down through the thousands of years? It's because if you can achieve this, it's most optimal to have your body support itself so that your muscles can then relax, you can get your mind off of your body and focus on your mind. Now, because in the West we're not used to sitting this way, it may take a very long time, but sitting in any way where you have to be actively holding yourself up, you will never be able to completely relax your body and focus on your mind. So don't expect yourself to be able to achieve this overnight. It takes many years in some cases, 1 minute at a time. But remember what the goal is. So first, your legs need to either be crossed or sitting flat on the floor. You should not have to be tiptoeing your feet on the floor. In my case, when I sit on a chair, I usually have to put a cushion because my feet don't touch the floor. So make sure your feet are able to rest comfortably on the floor. Next, your arms should be relaxed, loose, supported on your legs and out a little bit, so the air can pass through. Okay? Your back should be very straight, and this is really one of the most important parts. You can imagine your vertebrae stacked like coins, because if your spine is doing the job that it's meant to do, it will be holding you upright. And so gravity will not be trying to pull you forward or back. And this is something that, again, the Westerners have a hard time with because we're used to sitting in these chairs that encourage us to slump. And it's a really bad habit. And it might take us a long time to be able to sit and stand upright. But it's important to hold that in your mind. Your jaw and mouth should be relaxed. Inside your tongue should be up at the roof of your mouth, behind your front teeth, with your lips very lightly together. And that keeps your mouth from getting dried out. And the head should be as upright as you can, but that means it will be probably slightly tilted, but not so far forward that gravity would pull it forward and you'd slump over, or too far back. But they say that too far forward tends to make you more drowsy. Too far back, you stay hyper alert. So keep it comfortably upright. And again, what to keep in mind is you want to accommodate your body if it's not perfect, or you know you've had some problems with this posture. But the important goal is to be able to have your body comfortable and supporting itself without benefit of pushing against a chair, so that you can long-term meditate for long periods of time without worrying about your body. So the meditation we talked about last week was scanning the body, and there is that meditation is in a handout that you can get on the web. So we're just going to do an abbreviated version of that right now. Okay? So get your body in position. We've all come from busy days. So imagine, remember driving into the parking lot, parking, getting out of your car and walking in. You've come into the room, sat down. Think of your top of your head. Your head is relaxed. Your neck and your shoulders relax. Your back is straight. Relaxed. You can feel your bottom touching the chair or cushion. And you are here in this place. Right here at Kadampa Center. The next very common beginning meditation is called counting the breaths. And why do we try to use our breaths? Why do we get in the habit of counting our breaths? It's because the breath is a tool that is always with you, no matter where you are. You might use other tools to help you focus, like a candle or a flower. But what are you going to do when you don't have that with you? If you use your breath, you know it'll be right there with you. So the point is to try to count your breaths up to 10 and thinking of nothing else, just the counting. It doesn't mean you won't think other things, but when other thoughts come in your mind, just let them float away and come back to the count. And if you lose count, just start over again. And really congratulate yourself if you can get up to 10 and just be thinking of the count. And you start by breathing out, emptying your lungs. Then count in 1, 2. So what's the other value of counting? I'm sure we've all heard somewhere that when you're angry or just highly emotional, you should always count to 10 before you act or say anything. And why is that? Because if you can focus on counting, it brings your mind to a more neutral place. And from a neutral place, it's easier to get to a positive place. Thank you. So we bring our attention back to class. Sorry, it can't be longer, but I just want to give you a taste of what you might do on your own at home, okay? Here's a cartoon that, I'm meditating on my inability to meditate due to the fact that when I meditate, I can't stop thinking about how I can't meditate because I'm thinking about my inability to meditate. Is that correct? That's what our minds do a lot, isn't it? The monkey mind that we talked about, right? Meditation, be gentle with yourself. And this cartoon says, just keep breathing. Is it possible to die of itchiness? I guess I'm about to find out. I can hear at least 250 of them. I categorically refuse to move. This is not my idea of a good way to donate blood. That's the mosquitoes around. So this is the path to liberation. So like we talked about last week, our teacher says, start small. Even if all you can do is meditate for 1 minute, 1 good minute, that's enough. Stop when it feels good. And before you know it, if you're doing 1 good minute each day, you're going to be doing 2, then 3, then 10. Stop when it feels good. And don't let yourself get all wrapped up in this crazy thinking, because then you're going to start dreading it, and it's not its purpose at all. Because meditation, let's see, comes from the word gom, which means to become familiar with your mind with virtuous thought. And we'll be talking about what virtuous thought means to achieve a peaceful mind. So Lama Yeshe, we talked a little bit about how this organization, FPMT, that Kadampa Center is part of, Lama Yeshe was the founder. And FPMT is like the an organization that helps you to know that the teachings that are at an FPMT center are authentic. Doesn't mean that other Buddhist centers are not good or anything. It just shows you that if it is an FPMT center, you can count on what the teachings are here or the books that are sold in the bookstore are authentic Buddhist teachings. So Lama Yeshe says, the gross consciousness comprises the 5 sensory consciousness that we use every day. That's like taste, touch, hearing, sight. The subtle conscious can be things like intuition. They are subtle in the sense that we can't see or understand them clearly. The gross mind is so busy that it obscures the subtle. When the gross mind is no longer flashing or functioning, the subtle mind has a chance to arise. The gross mind has no strength, no power. The subtle mind has much more power to penetrate and comprehend. Meditation cuts the gross, busy mind and allows the subtle consciousness to function. So the reason that we try to let go of those big, busy thoughts about where we're going to go, what we're going to do, what's on the grocery list, blah, 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 blah. The reason that when we count, we try to let those things go is because that's when we can start working with our more subtle consciousness. And that's where we really start understanding and working things out. Stephen Hawking, I saw a biography that he actually directed, and he said something very interesting. we all know that he's an incredible genius, right? And he's figured out things that even most other genius scientists have not figured out. And he said that as he was getting more and more ill and lost his ability to write, because as you know, he used to think on the board and write all these complicated equations and all. And after a while, he wasn't able to do that anymore. And he more and more, he had to think about his theories without any benefit of doodling and scribbling things out and figuring it out on paper. So he said, I had to retain more and more of it in my mind. And the less able I was to express it outward and had to hold it inward, the more those thoughts just all kind of came together. And that's when I reached the most profound insights. So you see, it's really a very effective tool if we can work at it. And so why do we meditate? It's to tame your mind, to be able to control it and not let it control you. It helps to give us a focused mind, because a focused mind is peaceful and gives us flexibility of thought. It doesn't get us caught in ruts. In fact, the ability to focus is very important. You're probably all familiar with a scientist called Dan Gilbert. He actually did a study some years ago to find out what made people happy. When were they happy? So he made use of a modern invention of an iPhone and handed them out to thousands of people. I don't know how many, but many, many, many people. And he had them all have an app, and he would just ding them at random times. And they had to record what they were doing and what level of happiness they felt they were having and how engaged they were in the activity. And the very interesting finding at the end was that he found that the people who reported the highest, or the people who reported activities that gave them the highest level of satisfaction, were not necessarily doing anything pleasant. Sometimes they reported a high level of happiness when they were changing a dirty diaper or solving a difficult problem. Some of them were registered a lot of unhappiness when they were doing something really pleasant, like basking on the beach. So what he found was the correlation of happiness actually was more with the level of focus and engagement that the people reported. So that's just another piece of scientific evidence that shows that being able to meditate, to focus, to pull your mind in and direct it instead of having it direct you, is highly beneficial. Now, I want to underscore, especially for the people who were not here last week, that the Buddha, the person that we call the Buddha, was actually Shakyamuni Buddha, a sage from the Shakya clan. He was Prince Siddhartha. He was a real person. The word Buddha is a title. It's not his name. Buddha means someone who has achieved perfect compassion and wisdom. And he was not the only one who had achieved that. There were many other people at the same time as him that were Buddhas. There were Buddhas that came before him and since, and there are some here today. But the one that when we say the Buddha, we are usually referring to the historic Buddha, Prince Siddhartha, Shakyamuni Buddha. And the reason that he is very important to us is because he was a very important teacher. And he was one of the first people who not only was able to have those realizations, but was able to communicate them to us at a time when people were ready to receive those teachings. So we do not worship him. He's up here, as a reminder of our gratitude to him and to many other teachers, all these other pictures of the monks that you see around and Lama Atisha, all of these, they're all just very important teachers that we feel gratitude toward because they kept the, they brought the teachings to us and kept them alive and communicated them in ways that help us in our lives today. Okay, so a little bit about the history of Buddhism, and history is not my forte at all, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but a little bit about the history is that it started here in Nepal, or well, in India, but near the border of Nepal and Tibet. That's where the Buddha was. And in those times, all teachings were from the oral tradition. Okay, so the Buddha, Shakyamuni, had a few followers who paid attention to his teachings and memorized them because that's how learning was acquired and passed on in those days, in the oral tradition. And I've heard it said that the way it was, it's very important that the teachings be passed on exactly, unlike that game of gossip where you pass it from one to another and it changes and changes and changes. And one of the ways in which they were able to make sure that the teachings stayed authentic was monks in different areas would memorize the teachings and then would come together and recite to one another and make sure that they were all saying the same thing. So that's what I've read was the way that they kept the teachings authentic throughout the years until they were able to finally write them down. So about 2,500 years ago, the oral tradition started spreading gradually, probably mostly through the trade routes, and came down through India and Burma, down to Sumatra and Java, and up to China and Korea and Tibet and Afghanistan eventually. In the year 250 BC, Emperor Ashoka sends teachers to Sri Lanka and other regions. He was actually an emperor whose father and grandfather conquered large areas of land, and they were very bloody battles, very rough ways of conquering. And Emperor Ashoka just got disgusted with this, all this level of violence. So that's why he had heard that there was some teachers that were teaching nonviolence and a way to have a peaceful mind. So he sent teachers to this area to spread these teachings. So that having him do that really helped to speed up the spread of Buddhism. In the first century after CE, the teachings were first written, and the Mahayana tradition spread to Central Asia and China. And then in the 7th and 8th century, they spread up to Tibet. So you could just see where it started, and it really stayed in this area in the Eastern tradition for many centuries. It really is very new to the Western culture. Now, there are many Buddhist traditions because the Buddha gave a wide variety of teachings to suit many different dispositions, inclinations, and interests. You wouldn't teach someone how to use the same technique to teach everybody how to read. Everybody requires different methods, especially if you're in different cultures, different levels of education, different frames of reference. So even, it said he had like 84,000 teachings or something. It's just massive numbers of teachings. Well, was he teaching 84,000 different things? No, he was teaching the same things in different ways so that people everywhere could understand it. Just picture yourself trying to describe an orange or an apple to somebody who's never seen or tasted one. So if you're trying to describe this to a child in New York City, you would probably use examples that you would not use if you're trying to describe it to an adult in France. Okay? You use different words, different frames of reference, different language, but you're trying to explain the same thing, right? That's sort of why there are so many thousands of teachings from the Buddha. And also, it's why later on, teachers like Lama Atisha and Lama Tsongkhapa, who came in later centuries, they tried to reframe what the teachings were, because there were so many, people were having a hard time sorting it out and trying to make sense of it. So they organized it in different ways into, for example, it's called the Lam Rim. The Lam Rim means the graduated path. So it's a way of organizing the teachings that make it easy for us to follow. First you study on this, then that, then that, then that. Okay? And that's something that we could talk about in future classes. So, the essence of all of these teachings are the same. The wish to emerge from the cycle of constantly recurring problems known as samsara, which you'll learn about next week, and compassion for others, and the wisdom of realizing selflessness. Theravada, also known as Hinayana and Mahayana, are the most prevalent traditions. There's also Vajrayana, also known as the Tantric. So there are three main vehicles or scopes. The word yana means vehicle. So you use the vehicle that most suits your temperament, your culture, your ability to understand, but we all can go to the same place in these different vehicles. Now it's really important to not say, well, I'm a Mahayana and I'm better than the Theravada. Very important not to do that, because we're all the same. It's just a different approach. The Theravada, also known as Hinayana, is also known as the tradition of the elders. It was actually the first way that the Buddhist teachings were spread in, with this view. It's also called the lesser scope. Lesser does not mean less important. It just means smaller. It's more focused on the individual. And it's mostly in the southern tradition, South India, Sumatra, that south, not Georgia, Mississippi south. It relies on the sutras in the Pali language, spread from India to Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia, and emphasizes meditation on the breath to develop concentration, and meditation on mindfulness of the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena to develop wisdom. So one way to kind of summarize this vehicle, this approach to Buddhism, is be the change you want to be in the world. So if you really focus on improving yourself, then naturally everything around you will be improved as well. The Mahayana tradition, it's called a greater scope, and it's not greater because it's better. It's greater because it's focused a little bit more outward from the self. It's called also the universal vehicle because the focus is on all sentient beings and outside of us. More northern tradition, based on the scriptures recorded in Sanskrit, spread to China, Tibet, Korea, Vietnam. And though love and compassion are important in Theravada, there's more emphasis in the Mahayana. And it can be kind of summarized as, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want yourself to be happy, practice compassion. So it's just a little different way of, a little different motivation, but they're equally good. Now the third vehicle, the Vajrayana, also known as Tantra, that is a tradition that is best left to those who are really dedicated, such as like monks. It's a much more complex way of viewing things, and I honestly don't know enough about it to even give you a really good explanation. So we'll just leave that one to the monks, okay? Okay, now, within the Mahayana tradition, which Tibetan Buddhism is in the Mahayana tradition, there are different schools, so there are more subdivisions. And again, the reason for these subdivisions is because of where they were nurtured, the culture that they were nurtured in. So the different cultures and minds of the people that were trying to figure this out. There's a pure land where there's an emphasis on chanting, the Zen, which we are many familiar with, emphasis on meditation and introspection, and the Vajrayana, there's an emphasis on meditation on a deity to transform ourselves into the body and mind of a Buddha. See what I mean? That's not something we'd try to do, right? And although it's under the Mahayana tradition, it's also kind of its own category as well. And then there's Tibetan Buddhism, emphasis on study and debate together with meditation. Okay, so there's a real emphasis on learning something and then meditating on it and experiencing it until you have believe it, have the faith of conviction. You believe it because you know it to be true in your with your own thought process. And within that, there's a few different schools, the Gelug, Nyingma, Kagyu, and Sakya. So there's a lot of those different divisions, and again, it just has to do with the culture and the techniques, but the teachings are the same. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism of the Gelug school. Many people ask us, is the Dalai Lama like the Pope? Is he like the head of Buddhism? No, he is not. The Dalai Lama is a very important teacher and considered to be our spiritual leader. And he is that because we consider him to be our spiritual leader. He accepts that people think that of him, but he will always say, I am just a simple monk. And the Dalai Lama himself has teachers, okay? In the Buddhist tradition, the hierarchy is never on, like the president and vice president, whatever. The only measure of hierarchy is your level of knowledge, your level of study. So, of course, His Holiness is at a very high level of study and knowledge. But there are others that he considers to be even more knowledgeable than himself, that he goes to for teachings. Now, the other reason that the Dalai Lama is very important in this world is because up until recently, he was not just the spiritual leader of Tibet, he was also the political leader of Tibet. For many years, several centuries, they had in Tibet, they named the Dalai Lama as being both their political and their spiritual leader. And since the Chinese Revolution, 1959, and all the Tibetans were made into refugees to leave their country, and His Holiness is even a refugee from his own country, it's China and other places have tried to make his political position as a point of contention, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama feels like that has actually made things more difficult for other Tibetan refugee status. So he has actually given up his status as a political leader, and the Tibetans have since democratically elected their own Tibetan political leader in the refugee status. What do you call that? In exile. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So in exile. So now His Holiness the Dalai Lama is only a spiritual leader, and it's because we consider him to be that, and he's agreed to take on that role. So he's not the Pope. He's not a representative of some deity on earth. He's just the monk. Okay, so what does it mean to be a Buddhist? A Buddhist is someone who takes complete responsibility for their own happiness and suffering, looking inward to the mind as the source of happiness rather than seeking happiness in external phenomena. And yes, you can be a Buddhist and a Catholic. You can be a Buddhist and an atheist. Okay? You don't even have to call yourself a Buddhist. Venerable Rabina always says, you can be 1% Buddhist. It's okay. It's important that if you can learn some techniques and ways of thinking from this philosophy and apply them in your own life, it doesn't matter what you call it, as long as it's working for you. This is one of my favorite little sayings by His Holiness. The very purpose of religion is to control yourself, not to criticize others. Rather, we must criticize ourselves. How much am I doing about my anger, about my attachment, my pride, my jealousy? These are the things which we must check in daily life. Taking your own body and mind as a laboratory, engage in some thorough research on your own mental functioning, and examine the possibility of making some positive changes within yourself. Now, these things here, that you can have this attitude and use some other kinds of philosophies or ways of thinking about the world and be successful at this. What is different or specific to the Buddhist philosophy, the Buddhist attitude or approach to thinking, are basically these four things. If you want to try and understand Buddhism, you need to at least be willing to take these ideas as a theory. We are not only not asking you to believe them, we're asking you don't believe it until you've taken it and thought about it and tested it out yourself. But these are the four basic mindsets that are unique. I can't say it's unique, but probably unique to Buddhism. The belief of a precious human life. In Buddhism, it's very important to realize what a precious thing it is that we were born with a human body and the capacity to think, that we don't wake up every morning with claws and fangs having to kill just to live. The fact that we've been born with the body and the capacity to have soft hands and minds that can think and hearts that can develop compassion is very precious. There's a story that says it's as rare to find a human form as it is if there was a turtle in the middle of the ocean that comes up once every 100 years, and there's a random ring floating in the ocean and that turtle's head comes up in the middle of that ring. Just think of all the other sentient beings, that bazillions of furred animals and insects and all other kinds of sentient beings that don't have these tools that we are blessed with as a basic human being. We have the gift of intelligence, and we need to use that to develop our peaceful minds and to develop compassion and wisdom. So, precious human life, you need to think about that. Interdependence, very important. The fact that we're all interconnected. None of us is isolated in any way. Nothing that you experience, are, see, feel, do, are dressed with, eat, nothing is a result of one cause. Everything is a multiplicity of causes and conditions, interwoven. And that gives rise to that strong conviction of do not harm. Because we are so interwoven that any time we harm any anybody else, any other life, anything, the environment, anything, we are also harming ourselves. Next is the thought of dependent arising, also known as cause and effect. This moment gives rise to the next moment, to the next and the next. Okay, and this moment was caused by this one and the previous one and the previous one and the previous one. Okay, it's all cause and effect, dependent arising. And this gives rise to the conviction of karma and reincarnation. And both of these are things that we'll be talking about in future classes. And then the last one is the wisdom of emptiness. And that's a very unfortunate word, that word emptiness. None of us really like it. It makes us think about nihilism, that something does not exist. But what it really means is the wisdom of emptiness means it's empty of inherent existence. Okay, there's nothing that just exists in itself all by itself. That goes back to this interdependence and dependent arising. Everything is made from causes and conditions. Even our own bodies, the body that we have right now, there's probably not even a single cell that's the same cell that was there, you know, a year ago. Everything is regenerated all the time. So our body isn't just this static thing. It's empty of solidness. Even a rock has developed from molten pieces of chemicals that came together and solidified, and someday it's going to be broken down to sand and made into something else. Nothing is inherent, solid, unchangeable. Okay, everything changes. And then, also, so seeing things as they truly exist as a result of many causes and conditions, including ourselves. What is ourself? If you had to describe what is myself, well, is it the thoughts and attitudes that you are right now, or the ones you had 10 years ago? The body that you have now, you know, the culture, the whatever it is you are right now? No, we know that we are changing all the time. And why are we changing? It's because everything around us changes. And we're interacting with our environment. We are all a product of everything around us. We are not a static self. So this is a cause of a lot of problems in the future when we say, well, I am self and I'm like, you know, I'm like the most important. I'm the center of my universe. And so that's my thing. And this is I and my and mine. It's not yours. And then this sense of self as being independent starts causing a lot of problems, arguments, battles, wars, and bad politics too, right? Okay. So, this reminds me of a little story of Eckhart Tolle. Some of you may recognize that name as somebody who is a spiritual master. And he wrote several books. And he said that he got his beginning on a spiritual path years ago. He was a young man. He was really depressed. And he was so depressed, he decided he was going to kill himself. So he said, you know, I got everything I needed to kill myself, and I was there just ready to do it. And what I said to myself was, I just can't live with myself anymore. And then he said, wait a minute, I can't live with myself? Like, who's the I that can't live with the self? Like, what's the self that the I can't live with? You know, so then in thinking about that, that's when he came to realize that, you know, what is the self? Okay, it is not something static. It's something that is affected by and affects everything in the environment. Another thing that's very interesting about these things, some years ago I went down to Atlanta. You're probably all familiar with the fact that His Holiness is very interested in science. very interested in logical explanations. And he says, if there is anything that we are teaching in Buddhism that can be disproved, thoroughly disproved by science, then we'll just have to stop believing it. And one example of that was thousands of years ago, even some Buddhists believed that the world was flat. And when they were able to prove that the world was not flat, they said, well, we got to stop believing that. Okay? And that goes on today. And in fact, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is so interested in science and the mind and the brain. You've all probably read many studies about meditation and seen the monks with their heads all wired up and show that meditation makes actual physical changes in the brain and how it positively affects life. And even the examples I cited with Stephen Hawking and Dan Gilbert, there's a lot of scientific evidence that these techniques and ways of thinking are supported by science as being beneficial to our health, to our mental, emotional welfare. Well, anyway, this conference I went down to some years ago in Atlanta, the topic was depression. And His Holiness is up there on the stage with, I don't know, like 5 or 6 internationally renowned scientists, neurophysicists, psychiatrists, and biologists, and all these really high-level, profound researchers, all contributing what they have learned in their fields to the topic of depression, of what it is and how to resolve it. And one thing that was most memorable is a few of these experts said there are 3 things that seem to be common to all people who are depressed. One is they feel their life has no value. Second, they feel isolated, alone. Like they're just alone. Nobody can understand or help them. And the third is they all believe that there's no end to their suffering. So they feel the only way to end their suffering is to kill themselves. Well, just look at these here. This is a perfect antidote. And these scientists have found that having people meditate on similar thoughts here resolved, or at least improved, and many times prevented depression in college students. Because the first thing, you know, people who are depressed feel that their life has no value, we ask you to think about the precious human life. They feel isolated? Oh, by no means. We are very interdependent. They feel there's no end to their suffering? Dependent arising, everything changes. This is not only the conviction of karma and reincarnation, but also everything changes. Impermanence. Nothing stays the same. Nothing stays the same. Everything is always changing. So that depression they're feeling can change, will change. For sure. They just have to guide what it's going to change to, right? Okay. Okay, so now all these things we've been talking about are all part of our mind, right? Driven by the mind. So what is the Buddhist definition of mind? Remember last week we said if you ask a Westerner to point to their mind, point right here. You ask a Tibetan or a Buddhist to point to their mind, they'll point here, right? So the Western view of mind is mostly the brain, and that is not the Buddhist view of mind. The Buddhist view of mind is everything that is not physical. It's clear and knowing. It's a formless entity that has the ability to perceive objects. Another way of putting this is the mind has 2 qualities, clearness and awareness. Its function is to know. It is non-physical. Now, what's important, too, another important difference in the Western and Buddhist thought of the mind, we so commonly, every one of us, I bet it's, and I know I've done this many times, I know I shouldn't do this, but my heart's saying, oh, I just got to. You know, we separate our mind and our heart. We say, I knew I shouldn't do that, but I just couldn't help myself. My heart just told me to do it. You know, there is no separation of thought and emotion in the Buddhist philosophy. All emotions are caused by thoughts and attitudes. For an example, we've probably all had this experience of, you know, at work or somewhere else, you know, you see somebody and, you know, you make some kind of judgment about, I'm not sure that I like that person, you know, what he like, dropped a gum wrapper on the floor, he's probably irresponsible and, you know, it doesn't dress the way I think a person ought to dress, and, you know, you build the story and just kind of like, you know, I don't think I like that person, and you go on and, oh, he probably does this and that too, and you have this attitude of dislike toward that person. Then one day, you happen to have a conversation with that person. You find out, hey, he likes all the same stuff I do. Oh, wow, he's got kids of the same age as my kids. And, wow, we have the same job. And, wow, he's a really great guy. Now, what has changed? Has that person changed? No. Your attitude toward him, your emotion toward him has changed because your thoughts about him have changed. So emotions are only an expression of your thoughts. So the next time you find yourself saying, oh, you know, my head wants me to do this, but my heart is saying something else, study yourself very carefully, and you're going to find that there's actually something about the way you're thinking about it, your attitudes, or some experiences or references that you're not wanting to admit to yourself that are really affecting your attitude, your emotions toward whatever situation that you're in. So here's a little something that Lama Zopa, who is our current SBMT leader, says, what he says about the mind. He says, what is the mind? Mind has no color, no shape, and no material substance. It's different from the body, which has color and shape and is substantial. The basic definition of mind is that which is clear and able to perceive objects. In other words, mind is a formless phenomenon that knows things. As we referred to a little bit before, there are three levels of mind. There's the gross mind, that is your conscious thought. You know, oh, I got to get to the store, I got to get this, that, and the other thing. Okay. Then there's the subtle, which is your intuition. Okay, that little voice inside that talks to you. And if you quiet the grocery list, you can hear it a little bit better. And then there is the very subtle. And this very subtle mind is that which moves through lives and is affected by karma, or actually is karma. It's your experiences are registered down into your intuition, down into your very subtle mind. And that's what goes in our beliefs from one life to another. It's where the attitudes and understandings come to fruition. Okay? All right. Now, are there any questions at this point? We're going to go on to the Four Noble Truths and all of this has to do with the Four Noble Truths. Any questions? It's a lot to soak in, isn't it? Okay, and we'll go on. Oh, first, I forgot I had this slide. Okay, some important points. We already talked about it. But you'll often hear Buddhists talk about how mind is compared to a clear sky or a calm lake. thoughts are like clouds or reflections passing through or reflecting on, not an inherent part of pure water. There's many references to our teachers, especially our Venerable Being, will refer to your mind as like water. Okay, its essence is pure, and the negative thoughts, the disturbances in it, are like pollution in the water. And in order to get rid of the pollution, you have to know what is pollution and what is water. Or you might be getting rid of the water, right, and just keeping the pollution, okay? So that's part of what we're trying to do in Buddhism, is trying to figure out what the pollution is and take it out. And at first, when you're stopping and studying all that, you might think you're getting worse because you never paid attention to the pollution before, to the negative thoughts and the busy mind. So you think, oh my gosh, I didn't know I was thinking so many things when I sat down. I thought I was being calm. But then you start saying, oh my gosh, I must be getting worse. But no, really, you just think you are because you just never paid attention to it before. So you try to picture these thoughts and negativities as things that are not inherent in the water or in the sky, but things that can be moved out. The mind is consciousness, but it is not the brain, which is physical. They're very closely, they're interdependent and affect one another, but they are not the same thing. Consciousness includes attitudes and emotions. Mind and emotions are not separate. And the most important concept in Buddhism, this is very important, is that the mind is continually changing. It's like a river. It's always moving. It always looks the same, but it's different in any given spot. And we can change it. There's a firm belief in the ability to change our own minds and create the causes of happiness. Because if we couldn't change, well, then there would be no hope, would there? But we can always make changes. But you have to be aware of what is in your mind now and what you want to take out and what you want to nurture. So now we're going to get back to the Four Noble Truths. Yes, very good. Just can you wait for the microphone, please, so we can all hear. Thank you.
You said the mind is interdependent with the brain. So what if the brain dies when we are dying, it would mean mind dies. However, the very subtle, at least, or the subtle mind, probably or might not die. So what did you mean by interdependence with the brain?
Well,
and the next question is, how is mind and spirit related?
Okay. In Buddhism, we don't really talk about the idea of spirit. Okay, that's a mindset or an idea or philosophy that goes with other ways of thinking, okay? Usually spirit is an entity that's more, let's say, most people think of as more static, more independent, that moves from one thing to another, whereas in Buddhism, there's more an idea of this interdependence, so we don't really use that term spirit, okay? We use the term mind in this sense, okay? Now, as far as when you're dying, what my understanding of what happens in death is that what goes away, your gross mind, fades away down to the subtle mind, down to the very subtle. And everything is kind of imprinted down in that very subtle mind, which is what is carried from one lifetime to another. So the part of thought, my understanding of this gross thought that is more closely related to the physical aspect does indeed quiet down and fade. but that very subtle mind always stays, and all the thoughts and attitudes that you've nurtured and worked on in those gross and subtle levels of mind leave their imprint on that very subtle mind that goes from one lifetime to another. Does that help? Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. All right. The Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, as a review, is the first public teaching of the Buddha. Okay, after he sat down, first he experienced this life of luxury of every physical thing that he could possibly want. And he realized that having all the physical comforts did not bring him peace of mind. Then he did the other extreme. He became an ascetic monk, a hermit, and denied himself all physical comforts. And all he did was found himself to be uncomfortable and hungry and too distracted to think. So, you know, that wasn't the right way. So he decided, you know what, I'm going to just sit down under this tree and really think about what is the natural law, what is the natural order of things. And he thought it out. It was not a divine revelation. He thought it out the way that Einstein and Stephen Hawking sit down and figure out what is the natural order of astrophysics in the universe. The Buddha wanted to know, what is the natural order? Why do we suffer? What causes our suffering? And if there is a cause, how can we change that cause and eliminate it? Okay? So the first four teachings, the Four Noble Truths. Noble means of high integrity, high level, not royal, okay? Noble meaning very high quality of ethics, okay? So, why did he teach that suffering exists? It's like, well, of course we know that suffering exists, so why does he have to tell us? It's because he wanted us to stop and think, okay, you all think you know what suffering is, but do you really? What really is suffering? Is it just when you're physically sick? What does suffering mean? Okay? So suffering means dissatisfaction, complications, sickness, old age, death, rebirth, karma. Okay? Now, this rebirth and karma are in red because those are going to be talked about in future classes, okay? Okay, there's a difference between pain and suffering, okay? So he wanted you to look at what suffering really was. We all know people who seem to have everything they want, you know, comfortable home, good jobs, families, friends, and yet they seem to be really unhappy. They're suffering. In fact, the Dalai Lama tells a story of one time when he was traveling and he was a guest in the home of some very wealthy person who seemed to be really happy and successful, and he had to use the restroom, and he goes into the bathroom and he happened to open up the medicine cabinet. It's all these pill bottles of sedatives and all these medications that made him realize, wow, I thought this guy was really had it made. He was really happy, but he's not. Okay? And yet, on the other hand, we probably all know of people who, my gosh, they have nothing. There's so many troubles. They lose their jobs. Their child is sick. You know? But yet, they're able to maintain a positive attitude. They seem happy. So what does happy mean? Happy is the opposite of suffering, right? Suffering is a dissatisfaction and complications. Happiness in Buddhism doesn't mean, oh, ha ha, you know, just light, airy, fairy, okay? Happiness means that you were able to take things with equanimity, that you're able to view it from all sides, that you feel like you have the tools to accept and work through the complications and the dissatisfaction, that you can find a way to be satisfied or work with what is in front of you. It's interesting that, there's another scientist, not Dan Gilbert, or maybe it is him, who studied happiness in people. And he found that people grossly overestimate the level of happiness that something will give them. For example, he talked to many people who like won the lottery, and when they first won it, he'd say, "How happy do you think it will make you to have all this money?" "Oh, I'm going to be so happy. I'm not going to worry about anything. I'm going to get myself a new car, a new house. I won't have to worry about making a living." Then he would talk to them some years later and find that they very overestimated how happy that money was going to make them. And in fact, many cases, it made them unhappy because it brought many more complications to their life that they didn't have before. On the other hand, he talked to people who had lost their jobs, lost families, had huge losses, lost everything they had. And they felt sure that their life was over, that they'd never recover. And in talking to these people years later, most of them said, "You know, it was the best thing that happened to me. It made me completely review what was important in my life. It helped me reassess all my values and what I really wanted to do and what I really am." So you see, we really don't stop and think about what suffering is. And that's why he put that first. Stop and think about that first. So now, if you know what suffering is, then you can realize if something exists, it's got a cause, right? And this is what we're going to be talking about more tonight, what the causes of suffering are. Then the third noble truth was, if there's a cause, you can stop it. That's going to be more in next classes. And there's a way to do it. There's methods to stop the causes of suffering. And it goes also, verbalizing the path to end suffering, there are three principal aspects: renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. Those are things you're going to learn about in future classes, but just simply, renunciation means not that you're going to give up your life in your home and take the vow of poverty and all that. It means, you know what, I am just sick and tired of living this way. I am willing to really make an effort to change things. I want to renounce this misery that I've been having. That's what renunciation is. Bodhicitta is in the Mahayana path, the willingness to improve ourselves so that we can then help others. It's that attitude of the tradition, that you are willing to give a try. And the wisdom of emptiness means you are willing to give a try to understand how things truly exist. Okay? And so those are things we'll learn in future classes. So for today, we're going to focus on the first two, especially number two, the causes of suffering. Okay, so there's said to be six root afflictions or disturbing emotions. Now again, it's always a problem with translation, right? Basically, whether you call them afflictions or disturbing emotions or, you know, sins, I don't know what you could call them, they're basically the things that make us dissatisfied, uncomfortable, unhappy, not calm, all right? They are ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong view. But our teachers say that really they can all be boiled down to the first three, ignorance, anger, and attachment. So first we're going to briefly run through the pride, doubt, and wrong view and focus a little bit more on the others, okay? What these words mean, because again, these words may mean something very different from the Western definition. So pride is grasping at either an inherently existent I or an inherently existed mind. No, I am the center of the universe. This is my house, my car. You can't touch it. This is mine, all right? An exaggeration of your own quality based on transitory thing. Huh, I'm richer than you are. I can get away with it. You know, or I'm smarter than you. You never understand it. Okay, that kind of a thing, based on something that is fleeting. And an enhanced and mistaken self-view, as we talked about before. Doubt is a form of unhealthy skepticism that paralyzes action and growth versus a healthy critical inquiry. As we've repeated many times, everything about Buddhism is it's required that you do not believe it just because you read it or hear it. You believe it because you have a healthy critical inquiry, that you really think about it. You think of examples in your life, in examples in the world around you, and prove it to yourself to be true. But some examples of the unhealthy skepticism is like, oh, you know, I heard meditation is really good for you. I tried it once and it just didn't work, you know, that kind of a thing. It's a form of laziness, even just, oh, you know, I know that person can do it, but I don't think I can do it. And somebody else can do it, but I don't have the ability to sit down and meditate. Well, that is doubt. It's unhealthy. It's a form of laziness. That's what is meant by doubt. Wrong view, okay, not seeing things how they truly exist, or seeing a false cause, effect, functioning, or non-existent phenomenon as true or existent. Okay, one example of that might be, if I slaughter a cow and burn him in front of this statue, we're going to have good rains for our produce this year. Okay? That, in the Buddhist view, would be a wrong view. And if you would study the cause and effect, you really think about how does this thing connect to that thing, you really studied it and looked at it for examples, you would find that to be a wrong view. Or, I think that anybody who is, I was going to say Republican, but I shouldn't bring politics into it. But, you know, somebody who is a different category than myself, if they'd just all be killed or rounded up and put in a concentration camp, you know, it'd be a better world. That's a wrong view, okay? So that's what's meant by wrong view. So now we're going to go on to the three most important things. The first is ignorance. Ignorance, attachment, and anger, the three most important root causes of all of our suffering. And ignorance does not mean stupid. It means not seeing things, not seeing that which exists or the way in which things exist. There are basically two kinds. There's the ignorance of karma and ignorance of ultimate truth. Karma and emptiness are things that will be elaborated on in future classes, but basically, karma is based on what we talked about before, dependent arising and interdependence. It's very important to realize that when we think about any problem or any good thing, not just the bad things, to really recognize that they are the result of multiple causes and conditions. one of the best books I ever read about the history of the Tibetan problems, you know, there with the Chinese takeover and all of that. It was the history as told by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And, you know, for examples, you know, there was the Chinese invasion where they came in and, like, slaughtered a bunch of Tibetans and, you know, it was just a horrible, horrible mess. He says, well, yes, that was a terrible thing, but look at what the causes and conditions of that were. For many decades previous, we were isolationists. We didn't pay any attention to the outside world. And there were some things changing. There were a lot of clues happening over the years that if we paid attention to them and acted on it then, we could probably have avoided or made this certain situation not as bad as it turned out to be. So here is the Dalai Lama talking about history and helping us to realize that, you know, it's not like someone just all of a sudden came in with, you know, out of the blue and just one day this bad thing happened. No, it's a result of many, many causes and conditions. A few politicians, you know, getting relaxed and taking money and giving over some control to some Chinese diplomats that came over. You know, they gave up some of their control over some of the villages and politics in exchange for money and comfort and status. You know, many, many things contributed to it. You know, we might see, you know, a mother screaming at her child, you know, yelling at that child and say, oh, what a bad mother. But then when you look at the causes and conditions around it, you may say, oh my gosh, that child was about to run in front of a bus. You know, no wonder she screamed at it. You don't say, oh, child, please come back. You're going to get hit by a bus. No, you just, like, scream, right? Or, you know, somebody would come up and punch somebody else. Well, you know, like, why did that happen? It's probably not out of the blue. So it's really important to really look at everything. And you might come to the assessment that there's something there that needs to be changed, that some of these causes and conditions are not healthy and we need to change them. But at least you're doing it through a calm mind and logic, and your actions and words will be much more skillful and effective. Attachment. This is one that's really misunderstood a lot in the West. It exaggerates the positive qualities of an object and wishes to possess it. It's a grasping desire. Many people say, well, I'm really attached to my husband. I'm really attached to my kids. Doesn't mean if I'm a Buddhist, I can't be attached to them. You know, like we equate attachment with love and affection, but it is not that. Attachment is an exaggeration of their positive qualities, which actually is very unrealistic, because all of us, because we are all made up of many causes, conditions, have good things and bad things. And if you exaggerate the positive qualities to the extent where you don't see or ignore the negative qualities, you will definitely be disappointed. You will definitely not be able to sustain that level of a relationship with anybody or anything. We've all had the experience of getting something new, a new computer, a new car. Oh, if I get that computer or that car, it's got all the latest everything, and I'm going to be so happy. And then you get that car or you get a computer, and then after a little while, you know, it's, of course, in about 2 weeks, it's, you know, the last year's model already, you know, and like, oh, geez, you know, I really don't like it anymore. But if you would understand that, you know, it's going to change. You know, you get it because you like what it is and you enjoy the features, but recognize that it's going to be a change. It's okay. This little joke here, cartoon, says, do you have one that doesn't come with attachments? I'm a Buddhist. Okay, so I'm going to go on to the next thing because they're connected. Oh, here's another joke. Oh, Master, it's a proper for monkey's email as long as there's no attachments. Silly, huh? Okay, anger. It's the opposite of attachment. Exaggerates the negative qualities of an object and wishes to harm or avoid it. It's aversion. Or another definition is, anger is attachment that doesn't get what it wants. Okay, so that new car you got, that's just so wonderful. Well, the first, you've had it for a couple of months, and it breaks down, and suddenly it goes all the way from attachment all the way to aversion. You just can't, I can't get, wait to get rid of this car, get a new one. It very commonly happens in relationships. When you first meet someone, oh, that guy or gal is just, they're so nice. They think I'm great. They're so kind and nice and smart. And then the first time Joey or Sally cheats on you, suddenly, you know, they're like the worst. Like, oh, they're just so horrible and thoughtless and terrible, you know. So you could see how the two sides of the coin, the attachment and the anger, are exaggerations of qualities and not the way things really are. If you can think of someone that you really, really love, or even you think of yourself, someone who really loves you, and they if they don't see that you also have some negative qualities and can accept those, it's not going to be something that's sustainable. So it's really important. So whenever you start to feel angry about something, say, what was I expecting? I was attached to some kind of idea of what this thing is or should be or what it should be doing for me or what it is. And now I'm really mad because what I was expecting didn't happen. So you suddenly changed, switched over from an attachment to it to an aversion of it. Okay? Many people ask, well, does that mean I can't take any pleasure in anything? If I can't be attached to anything, does that mean I can't enjoy it? Not at all. Enjoy the heck out of it. In fact, appreciate its positive qualities. But just understand that it is not perfect. The positive qualities are things that are positive to you. You know, you might go somewhere in the world and ask for the best meal in the world, and they might bring you a bowl of eyeballs or something, you know? And I say, well, this is our very best. But, you know, I'm a vegetarian. That is not appealing to me, right? But they get insulted because that's their best, and you think it's kind of yucky, right? So you can enjoy things, but understand that you're enjoying it because there's qualities that are appealing to you that maybe fulfill some of your needs, your expectations, desires, and preferences. But if it changes, that's okay too. In fact, Venerable Rubina gives a little example of, you know, you might be attached to the thought of chocolate cake. Well, if attachment made you happy and you really love the chocolate cake, that means eating more of it would make you more and more and more happy. But we all know that it's true, there's a certain amount of cake that you can eat and you're not very happy anymore, right? So you can enjoy it, but just realize that it's what all of its qualities are. There are any questions? Almost the end of the evening. Yes.
I think your examples are nice, but they are easy to understand. However, what about the more severe examples? Can it be also that easily explained? I'm thinking about when there are war times, mothers are losing their children or they are dying from hunger nowadays everywhere and have done so during all times, or the American Indians were nearly relinquished by disease and conquistadores and so on. So the question for me is it a matter of attachment? You have to let go of anything, and if your mind is so far advanced that you really can let go of even your nation, your child, of everything, that is even under those conditions when you can be happy? Is it that extreme, and is anybody capable of doing it that way?
That's an excellent question. There's a story that's told about a mother that went to the Buddha. She was just devastated because her only child had just died. She was just devastated and asked the Buddha, "Is there anything that you can do to help my grief?" And he said, "Yes, there's something I can do for you. But first, you must go and bring me back a handful of mustard seeds. Go from one house to another, and if there is the house that has been untouched by death, let them give you a seed. And when you have collected a handful of seeds, come back to me." So she went from one house to another, asked, "Is this a house that has been untouched by death?" No. They couldn't give her a seed. To the next one, to the next one, to the next one. And then she came back to him empty-handed, "Buddha, I could not find a house that has been untouched by death." And he says, "Except it is a very sad thing, and you can grieve over your child, but if you understand that if we are born, we must also die. It's a part of the natural order of things. It will help you to tolerate your grief more and help you to put it in more perspective and to go on." Does that help?
I can see that it puts everything into perspective, but I cannot see so easily that suffering is ended by it. There is still a huge difference between those.
Yes, there really is. And this is just a little introductory class, and we don't really, first of all, don't have time to, but also you need to build up to the ideas of working more toward understanding what karma is and coming to the ability to accept that kind of theory of dependent arising and subtle mind carrying on from one life to another and how one affects the other. That might help to explain or give a better answer to what you're asking. But at this point of the level of material we're at, I really, first of all, I'm not qualified to give you an answer at all. But even some hint of an understanding through that I've acquired through just studying for years myself, which is not an authoritative answer, right? But in order to get any level of satisfaction to an answer like that, you need to understand more about karma, because that's all interrelated. But the most important thing, a beginning thought that you can have, is if you could at least put your worries, your problems, into a greater perspective, right there, that might help you to deal with it in a more productive way and help to keep you afloat while you're figuring it out. Does that help? It's not really an answer, but maybe it's a beginning.
I'm thinking about historical
events
like Holocaust.
Yes, yes. You are absolutely right. It is not easy. It's not easy to accept and understand why an innocent child might be born into a war-torn country and get raped as an infant and cut up and butchered, okay, which unfortunately does happen. It's not easy to understand or accept why somebody who's mean and cruel seems to succeed and have money and power. It's not easy to understand all of these things, but studying more and more about the cause and effect and dependent arising and all of these things, it takes a lot of time and a lot of work. But you don't try to figure out how light travels through the universe or what's happening on galaxies. That's not the first thing. If you're trying to understand physics and start by studying those things, like E equals MC squared, you're never going to understand it. So you start out by telling yourself, you know what, I'm tired of feeling so unhappy and dissatisfied and confused, and I'm ready to start being serious about thinking about how things are. So you start by learning the principles of gravity, that if I drop a pen, it's going to fall to the floor. So you learn the principles of gravity and inertia and all these simple basic principles first. Because if you don't start by understanding those most basic principles, then you will never properly understand the college and professional levels of it. So determine for yourself, if that's what you choose, to be systematic about it. And start with these basic ideas and prove to yourself the cause and effect. The cause, you're going to learn about this more in future classes about karma, but all results are similar to the cause. So if I want positive outcomes, I need to start with a positive mind, which will result in positive thoughts and words and actions. And even though it might look like I'm not winning the race, ultimately I know I will feel confident that it will have a positive outcome. And vice versa. If I harbor negative thoughts, then the words that come out of my mouth surely one day will be negative. And the actions that go with it will be negative, and there will be a negative outcome. So you start small, and then one day maybe you will get some glimpses of the answers to those bigger questions that you're looking for. And I hope you do. So we're at past 8:30. Thank you all so much for your patience. Next week I will not be here. Sandy Carlson, an excellent teacher, will be here taking my place next week, but I will be back for the last two classes. So thank you all so much. Let's dedicate all our efforts toward more peaceful minds and hearts and a better world. Thank you so much. Oh, I just also need to just quickly mention generosity. You know, we all mentioned that we are so grateful that this place exists, that we have wonderful teachers that taught us and passed us on, and we need to recognize the generosity of those who came before us by making whatever contribution that we can, at whatever level, even if it's the tiniest bit, to make sure that this is here for you in the future and for other people like us who need it. And there's Matt Damon actually had a wonderful idea. He started a nonprofit, and he said, I would rather 1 million people gave $1 each than one person give $1 million. Because when you give even a dollar, or some of your time to volunteer or whatever, you are making an investment into yourself. And when you make that determination to invest for yourself, it gives you a mindset that you value that, and you will value it in yourself. So thanks again. Good night. Be safe.